Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champions. It's great to have you back with us. Today in our virtual studio, I've got Andrew Rechtman. Andrew, you've had an illustrious career. You've been involved in the property sector in many different guises, and even before that in financial services, in various roles. Please tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into today's conversation, where we'll talk more about property and what PropTech means for the industry, or what it could mean.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here and great to talk with a whole bunch of people. A bit of my background, I've been very fortunate, I think, in my career to have worked with some great organizations. I actually spent 10 years at the start of my professional career working with Bain & Company as a strategy consultant in a range of industries, predominantly tech and telco, but also a little bit of financial services, and went to the client side after about 10 years to work with PayPal, mostly in Australia, but part of the management team at PayPal Australia, where I led up their product, government relations, small and medium business growth, new development and strategy. So really a great learning experience on how digital combines with financial services. And the last 5 years of my sort of executive career I spent at REA Group, which is one of the leading property portals, where I was lucky enough to lead the residential team, also to be chief customer product officer, and had good exposure to the partnership that we had with National Australia Bank. So again, came back a little bit to the financial services space. The last 2 years, for personal reasons, I've moved to Barcelona and been working as an advisor and a consultant with a range of property portals here in Europe, including Adevinta Group, Schibsted, as well as the US through Realtor.com or Move Inc., the parent company there. And most interestingly, really with a bunch of PropTech startups, particularly those like iBuyers, who are combining the FinTech and PropTech world in their new value propositions.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Andrew, I mean, in many of our conversations, we speak about partnerships. We speak about the kind of ambitions that an organization, however big, and you spoke about NAB as an example, can't achieve on their own. So let's maybe dive in a little bit about and talk to us a bit about that organization from a partnering perspective. Take us back to that story of origin. How did it start? Why were they looking at partnership? Why does it even matter?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. It's probably the second time I've explored a partnership with NAB. When I was at PayPal, interestingly enough, we were looking at a partnership with NAB, and we never made anything happen, but it was really interesting to see. And certainly from our perspective as REA Group, a property portal, we realized that our core business had limitations. At the end of the day, there are only so many properties going to be published every year. You can only monetize them to a certain level. Yeah, we had these fantastic customer relationships. We had technology capability. But really, we didn't have the ability to fully develop that capability in the financial services space, which was an obvious adjacency. So for us, we're helping people find property and then, you know, get in contact with an agent and find the property they want to buy. But the key ingredient is connecting that to the financial services piece. And when we found a partnership with NAB, they were looking at it from the other way around, where they had all the financial service experience, the access to, you know, capital, et cetera. But perhaps they didn't have the relationship with the customers, being property seekers, nor did they necessarily have the technical or technology capability to innovate and bring products to market quickly. So really the genesis of the partnership was both parties realizing that digitization of financial services was the future, and that changes to our existing businesses and partnership would actually enable us to do that more effectively. So that was really the core of the journey. And I think it started with the top executives. Actually, not with myself, but with the CEO of REA Group and the senior execs at NAB, finding that common ground and seeing a vision for the partnership. And after they had that vision, then it cascaded to the teams to actually develop the partnership over time.
Now, I'm curious, was it obvious to the parties what form of partnership should take place here? Was digitization providing enough of a clear path as to what it should look like? Or was it more of a case of why we should partner? But there's a whole plethora of different ways in which we could partner and how we could go about doing that.
Now, that's a super good point, because I think it was much clearer why the partnership should happen and what the long-term vision and opportunity was than exactly how or what the partnership should be. So the foundation was the why, and then we experimented a lot. And I would say I've left REA 2 years ago, but from the outside in, I think the partnership is still evolving and the experimentation is still happening. Largely because in something as complex and as big as, you know, creating a financial services product, online, you cannot envision day one what that's going to look like on day 365 or probably year five as well. So for me, the why was most important, and then we iterated over a period of time, and even in the first 6 to 12 months, the partnership foundation has changed a lot as we learned collectively what worked, what didn't work, and where we should take it.
I know that's interesting when you said, you know, that you can't envision up front of exactly what it would look like, right? You can anticipate, you can have a starting point, you can think about possible scenarios of what it could be, but you can't anticipate everything up front, right? And that kind of brings for me kind of the role of leaders in this process and to what degree, and I think you've alluded to it already, the CEOs of the two organizations became involved. Maybe talk us a little bit through their involvement from the start. Did it change? Did it morph? Did others take on a different leadership role to sustain the partnership? Talk us a little bit through that.
Yeah, look, and I wasn't intimately involved in that first part, so I'll give my observations from a little bit from afar of what I saw happening. But I think they're two different sized organizations. REA is in 1,200 people at the time, including 400 outside of Australia. So we're relatively small, and NAB would be 40,000 employees probably. So very differently sized organizations. And to some extent, while there was CEO commitment on the NAB side, it was probably also the next level down, given the size of that org, that was integral to really seeing the vision of the partnership. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely at the CEO level at REA and at the CEO, but probably next level down within NAB. And then once that foundation was set, the trust was built and the commitment was made, and it was a commitment both financial and of time to progress the partnership, it cascaded down to next levels in the organization. On our side at REA, we actually dedicated the time of our CFO, who had a background in banking, had worked with ANZ, one of the other big banks in Australia. And so he took the lead really in representing the REA side in the partnership and creating that vision and working through it all. And then obviously we involved product teams, technology teams, strategy teams in actually defining what the solutions might be.
Now, this is interesting because I guess one of the things that I know in our work together we pick up on is how much that senior person has to understand the other organization, not that they're just their own organization. They almost need to anticipate what could go wrong, or into the corollary, what could go right in the other organization, what kind of challenges they might anticipate. And therefore, how do we make it easier to partner rather than just saying, let me fix things on our side? So it's really, really interesting that you mentioned that in that context of that example of that CFO. Now, when I look at partnerships between financial institutions and property organizations, whether prop tech, whether specifically platforms, whether other service providers, there's a whole plethora of these partnerships. I mean, there's almost like no day, you know, when you start searching, you'll find something new, right? I mean,
there was one yesterday between UniCredit in Italy and one of the property portals there in Mobiliare. So you don't have to look very far.
Exactly. So from your experience, what would be some of the telltale signs that this is a partnership that could potentially endure, that could potentially have legs, that could potentially become something other than the original reason that's easier, I guess, to predict, versus ones that are just fads, that are just there because, you know, it makes for a good headline, it might get some attention, but nothing really more than that. And they kind of fade into insignificance fairly quickly.
Yeah, look, the reality is that most of the partnerships in between portals and financial services companies, particularly banks, are at their core advertising or channel partnerships, generating leads between the two organizations, typically for the financial service institutions from the prop tech businesses, and particularly from portals. But I think what distinguishes those that are going to go further is a commitment to a long-term partnership, and that's beyond the headline. Obviously, you can announce a press release anytime saying whatever you like, but it's a genuine commitment for a multi-year partnership. And a joining up of the executive teams. I think when you have, you mentioned it earlier, that mutual understanding and mutual vision between senior leaders in both organizations, you start to build that social capital, if you like, between the two organizations, as well as the financial capital that's invested. Then I think you start to see a true partnership emerge. And that then expresses itself in a number of ways, oftentimes through more adventurous commitments in terms of product, more ambitious goals in terms of joint revenue outcomes or profitability outcomes, and a commitment to actually learn and grow together. And that's actually one of the things, is jointly accepting that maybe what you're doing hasn't worked for a time around, not abandoning that, and then learning, pivoting, adjusting. That is a really important element of growing a partnership over time.
I guess it also gives us a sense that developing and growing a partnership can happen in steps. You don't have to figure it out all at the beginning, right? You can start with the channel partnerships because those are fairly easy, straightforward, standardized, lots of market data out there, lots of good lessons we can learn from. But it doesn't stop you from creating something unique. It doesn't stop you from reaching out once there's the trust levels have grown, once there's an ambition to take this thing further, to digitize the acquisition, for example, then it doesn't stop you from reaching out to the next level. It really depends on what really stands in the way. In other words, what stops you from taking the next step? And I guess that kind of leads me to a question around what does really stand in the way? If you think about partnerships that began as channel partnerships and never got beyond that, casual dating in some respects, some pointing out the novelty of it kind of wore off and you couldn't see it in the numbers that it could sustain, whether it's the number of leads or whichever way they measure it, versus those which managed to reinvent themselves, which managed to see, hang on, there's a window here to create the next level. There's a window here, whether it's through new offerings, whether it's through really disrupting the market and thinking about the market opportunities differently. What would you say stands in the way of those who weren't able to turn a channel partnership into something bigger, into something that may have more potential?
Yeah, well, I think it's specifically in the prop tech and bank partnership space. I think there's a whole bunch of examples outside of that as well, but probably they're the softer side of the partnership. The cultural elements are really important. As I said earlier, you've typically got a more nimble, smaller learning organization culture in a technology-oriented prop tech business and a more industrial-sized bank business, which is built for five nines scalability and security. And how do you mesh those two cultures together? So I think that is really one of the key elements is how you bring those two cultures together. That follows through to the operating rhythm that you set up. Do you create a joint venture or do you create a joint working team? Do they co-locate in the same space to create their own new culture? Those sort of soft elements I think are really important. In addition to that, there is, as I mentioned earlier, just a sheer top-down commitment to resources. And if you don't apply the sufficient resource, particularly on a bank side, but also, frankly, on a property portal side, there's a lot of claims on tech resources. If you don't partition aside those resources, give them time to work through the opportunity and the problem solving, it's going to be hard to sustain anything. And a little anecdote, right through the NAB partnership and today as well, REA maintained advertising relationships with other banks. So there was still the ability to go on dates, if you like, with the other banks, but the core of the partnership with NAB. And I wouldn't say that there's been a home run hit yet in that relationship, but the exploration and the ability to learn and grow together has been crucial to both sides evolving their businesses.
Andrew, we started the conversation talking about PropTech, talking about digitization and how technology is making firms rethink their approach to strategy in the sector, to differentiation, and to the partnerships, whether existing partnerships, taking those to the next level, or new partnerships, perhaps, and having multiple partnership discussions. So with that in mind, let's talk a bit more broadly about PropTech. What is happening in that space?
Well, I mean, PropTech is an incredibly wide space. There's, clean building technology all the way through to how you manage your finances. But where I work mostly and where I think is probably most relevant to some of your clients is that intersection of prop tech and fintech. And that I think is the space that is particularly interesting right now. So you've got all sorts of innovation happening, sometimes from partnerships between existing players and oftentimes from startups in how do you change the way home financing happens? How do you enable people to have different experiences in saving for a deposit or making the down payment on their first property purchase? All of those things are happening at a really rapid pace. Cash buying offers in the US, there's a whole power buyer dynamic happening where businesses are starting up, they're enabling a more friendly transaction process with financing that enables cash offers rather than the traditional mortgage offer. And in every market, really, there's some variation on that theme based on what the local market needs and requirements are. There's also a lot happening in the rental space. That is, I think, one of the earliest areas that in prop tech is going to see different ways of paying. Think about some of the very archaic ways of dealing with rentals, from the applications process, to verifying people's ability to pay, or the way payments are made, deposits. These things really shouldn't exist in a digitized world. So there's an enormous amount of of activity in that space, and even just in the core digitization of property investment. Why? How do people buy property? How do the people sell property? Fractional investment of property, iBuying, where people are selling not to another property owner, but they're selling to a company in 3 or 4 days. Those kind of innovations are really at the cutting edge of prop tech and fintech combining. And I think that's where there's some really interesting opportunities for businesses to explore partnering, because pure property businesses won't necessarily have all of the answers, nor will the pure financial services businesses. So I'm really enjoying working in that space right now.
Yeah, it's such a good point. I mean, we don't always have all the answers, but we have willing partners and willing participants to explore and come up with new answers. That's where partnerships can get really exciting. I guess that leads me to an important part of our conversation, which is to talk about challenges, about what stands in the way. So if the technology allows us to do many things that we couldn't do before, and we could demonstrate a lot of these aspects, they're not just deep tech. They are tech that is available, that is already adopted, maybe not equally well. What that therefore then stands in the way of partnerships, you know, realizing their full potential?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and I think as I observe it, a lot of the innovations that are happening in the market tend to come from startups that perhaps have backers rather than necessarily partners. And I think one of the challenges of partnerships is that it's hard to envision and to create a culture to deliver that vision, what the future looks like. And when you're putting together organizations of different sizes, different backgrounds, different cultures, it's not always clear how you create that common view of what the future should be. So I think that investment of time up front to get that common vision and that common view of the future is critical to overcoming one of those barriers. Other barriers can simply be a meshing of, you know, priorities and not having the ability to maintain a priority for a partnership over a long period of time, when at the outset there was lots of excitement, but 6 months later you haven't yet delivered, or 9 months, 12 months later you haven't yet delivered. So how do you maintain the priority of the partnership when there are lots of other distractions, lots of other new shiny objects around to invest in? So I think those are the two big things that prevent partnerships perhaps having the same success sometimes as startups, which are maniacally focused on that one goal. How do you recreate in a partnership that same culture and excitement of innovation and actually exploring a new opportunity?
Andrew, one of the things you spoke about, and certainly we're seeing in the fintech space or instigated or accelerated through fintechs, is borderless banking, is borderless financial services, is the ability to provide through software and through the right approach to regulation, things that you couldn't offer before and well beyond your home market. Do you see the same in property? Do you see that the kinds of solutions that you're speaking about here do scale and get applied well beyond the local borders or the local problem that we're trying to solve?
Yeah, it's actually, I'm smiling because this is something that I was actually in a board meeting yesterday with a business that is across Central and Eastern Europe. And one of their propositions is that they've been able to scale prop tech across markets. And it actually has been very difficult. There are not many examples of businesses that have scaled across markets. There are some traditional real estate agencies, obviously, that have, you know, multi-market operations. But in the prop tech space, it's been hard. And I'm working with a couple that are trying to do that in Eastern Europe and actually in Western Europe. And there are a lot of regulations that are different. There are a lot of local customs that are different. But underlying the experience is actually really the needs of customers the same. So I think there can be cross-border value propositions, and there can be economies of scale in developing solutions for multiple markets, but it does require, again, a level of investment of time and effort up front to identify which markets actually have those commonalities and how are you going to develop a proposition that won't be exactly the same in each market, because everyone has its own nuances, but utilizes a lot of the same capabilities.
And I guess a related question for me would be, we've had a guest on our podcast some time back, a futurist, who spoke to us about how this is such an opportune time, not just for large markets, not just for the US and China and India, but for much smaller countries to innovate, for much smaller countries to try new approaches, to test new business models. And the fact that there is an element of economics of scale, certainly in terms of the use of data, does not mean that one cannot innovate, does not mean that a small market is the main blocker to try new partnerships and to bring new value propositions to those markets. So I wanted to ask you, in the property space, is small a hindrance?
Yeah, though I actually think it's small. Small is good in some ways. It was interesting, the same board meeting that I had yesterday in the Central European markets, they were saying they could build a unicorn business worth $1 billion in three cities in Eastern Europe: Romania, Bucharest, Budapest, Hungary, and Warsaw, Poland, which are not the world's biggest cities by any means. And in addition to that, there are far fewer barriers to entry in those markets. There's more innovation, and often those smaller markets are more open to alternative solutions, particularly technology solutions, than well-established mature markets where you've got big existing players. So I think that small and emerging markets are probably the most likely places where you're going to see prop tech innovation and fintech innovation. And that, I think, has been proved out in Southeast Asia in particular, where there are many, many small markets that have really revolutionized the way property is done in a way that hasn't happened in the more mature Western markets.
And I guess where that kind of leads me is also the topic of extraordinary partnerships. And when I talk about extraordinary partnerships, I'm not necessarily just talking about scale, but I'm talking about impact. I'm talking about the participation of non-traditional players, a government, for example, in its role or willingness to digitize some of the key processes, the role of regulation, and to what degree we can experiment in the market. So perhaps talk to us a little bit about, I guess, not the unique necessarily, but the case where partnership means partnerships beyond the trade, and any aspects that you might want to bring to light there that property companies should be thinking about.
Yeah, no, obviously property is a highly regulated business. And if you're thinking about getting into the transactional component, there are businesses, for example, in Australia where I'm from called PEXA. There was a startup that was founded through partnerships amongst banks and other technology businesses, which digitized the exchange of property titles, which is a rather boring topic in some ways, but hugely essential and actually very valuable. And that required a high level of government collaboration. And that was a project that ran over 10 years because there needed to be a buy-in from not just the national government, but regional governments that own the property title experience. So I think when you're starting to get into the core of the property technology business, you probably do need that close collaboration with governments. There are other elements that don't. So I think it depends on the ambitions that you have for the partnership, the type of services and problems you're looking to solve for your customers. But in many instances, if you're going to go deep into a property transaction, alignment with governments and regulatory authorities is essential.
I guess, Andrew, last question from my side. You know, when I think about property industry, in which age plays a role, in which, I mean, we were looking recently, for example, and we do extensive work in the sector, where the average age of estate agents has grown and is now sitting somewhere in the 50s. And they bring a lot of experience into the sector, but sometimes there's also a reluctance to adopt new technology. There's a reluctance to learn new skills. And I kind of wonder, if I had to ask you your message to the younger participants in the sector, for someone who is in their 20s or early 30s, who's looking at the property sector and saying, I could make a dent here. I could contribute towards changing the face of the industry. Because I've seen the pain and I've seen the friction that is very often associated with a property transaction. What would be your message to those? They may come from outside of the industry. They may be new to the industry. Yeah. They may have very different ideas about how the property industry should be changing. But what would be your message to them?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when you look at successful property startups, in particular prop tech startups. A lot of them are founded by people who simply had a bad experience and couldn't understand why it hadn't been digitized. And they go, this is crazy. Why am I going through this old world paper-based experience when it would be relatively simple? It's not deep tech, as you said earlier, to actually develop better experiences. So I do think there is a role for younger people to envision what a better experience could be developed, could be delivered without being encumbered by this old world, this is the way we've done it for the last 20 years. I would challenge you a little bit though on the property sector being resistant to technology. And again, it varies probably market by market, but even those who are not in their 20s, the more established property business owners, especially real estate agents, often very open to working with new technologies. They typically live on their mobile, so they love mobile technology. And actually in most markets, you do see a real willingness amongst real estate agents to adopt new technology. One of the challenges is there's just so much of it for them to choose from, and they're overwhelmed. It's quite a fragmented business. So they tend to really struggle to actually get across all of those technologies, which opens up opportunities for umbrella organizations or larger businesses to consolidate and package up that new technology for a real estate audience. So that's where I think, you know, businesses that are perhaps larger, not startups, can really find a niche to connect the desire of both young people and existing industry participants to do things in a better way, to do things in a digital way, but cut through all of the complexity and the fragmentation that is typical of the property industry and combine that with, you know, new technology that makes a whole lot easier for people to actually operate in that space.
Fantastic. Andrew, thanks for spending time with us today. Thank you for sharing your experience and varied interactions in the sector, and very much looking forward for this episode going live on our podcast series. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.